And obviously delighted John Howard was in Adelaide yesterday to see the 1 millionth Australian Workplace Agreement signed off. That landmark event in industrial relations comes 7 months after the controversial Work Choices legislation was introduced. One union leader observed, "It's a sad day when the Prime Minister celebrates a deterioration in workers' rights." Our guest today believes any celebration is certainly short-sighted. Bill Shorten is convinced that in the long term, the new IR laws will cost John Howard government. Indeed, they're seen as the best chance Labor has had in ages to win. And if they do, what does it mean for Bill Shorten? He's pre-selected for the relatively safe seat, I think it is, of Baranbinong, and many see him following the same path as Bob Hawke from the union movement into big-time politics. There's no doubt his presence at the Beaconsfield mine rescue earlier this year lifted his profile in the wider community and thrust him well and truly into the forefront of the union movement, particularly in its attack on the industrial relations legislation. And right now, they're fighting to win back the support of the one-third of trade unionists who deserted Labor and voted Liberal at the last election. As campaigning hots up next year, we're going to see a lot more of the man who's going to speak to us now, Bill Shorten.
It's a pleasure to be here, especially talking to South Australians as a Collingwood supporter. Your season went 1 week longer. I could talk to you about work choices and why work choices is a bad idea and why they're unfair laws, but I suspect that if you're part of the 70% of the Australian electorate who already have concluded that the case for work choices hasn't been made, I won't repeat to you what you already know. Although, in the generous introduction that I was provided with, I'd say it's far less a case of the one-third of trade unionists who voted Liberal deserting Labor. I would say it's a case that the Prime Minister has deserted Liberals who are members of trade unions by attacking their conditions. But instead, what I want to do is take this nice opportunity on a Friday afternoon in Adelaide to talk about the world after work choices. What are the issues that a nation like Australia needs to think about? What are the public policy frames which are going to be important for the future beyond the temporary irritations of these unfair laws? Australia, after all, is a country which is too small to run the rest of the world, but it's too big to ignore. Long after the commodities boom comes off, what are the issues which are special to Australia? What will give Australia its opportunity in the future? And I think that one particular statistic will provide the focus for my talk today. The good news is, and South Australia in particular knows this, with your population demographics, we're living longer now. And a baby girl born this year can expect to last with all her faculties intact, and perhaps with her mobile phone, be it next year or whichever, till 2106. She might even get to be 120. But on average, the actuaries tell the super funds, only 100, and only 96 for the baby boys born now. This year, in fact, to back up this optimism, CSL's released a vaccine for cervical cancer, and a cure we found apparently is emerging for Alzheimer's, which is vigorous walking, which indeed might bring up the female average to 103. Yet in all the other areas of this most curious new century of life, we see change and challenge. We see the slow emasculation of manufacturing, the disastrous new price of energy, the rise of a militant Islam prepared to die a fiery death in order to discourage our tourism. We see perhaps the re-emergence of a neo-communism in Russia, a neo-conservative interim, by contrast, fueled perhaps in part by terrorism in the United States. We see a furious new competitiveness in India and China, more divorce, more single-parent families, more children conceived by women in their 40s, less children conceived overall, a new generation unfortunately convinced that children are a choice to be delayed by virtue of income and mortgage, another item to be defined by opportunity and career. Of course, we also see perhaps fewer people belonging to unions than 30 years ago, but also, I must add, fewer people belonging to mainstream organised religion. And we have 100 years, I'm suggesting to you today, to get used to these changes and navigate around them somehow on a planet which is warming and crackling with ever fiercer lightning. Storms that bring, unfortunately, however, insufficient water to prevent the onset of deserts and the melting of the glaciers and icebergs everywhere. So how do we cope? I believe today that we need a centenarian strategy. And this I've been influenced by excellent talks provided by American researchers in the last decade. We need, I suggest, 100 years of good acceptable life on Earth, the Earth as it soon will be, with technological change and global economics altering around us everything that we used to recognise as who and where we are. Now how do we do this? How do we cope? How do we ride the tsunami of future shock on the frail surfboard of the fair-go tradition and a European tendency of mind in a busy Asian world? How do we compete with India and China, the economic miracles? How do we keep our mind calm and our gaze clear while all around us are saying the sky's falling and life as we know it's changing forever? Or indeed, when I road tested this talk to a group of our delegates at Portland in Victoria's southwest, as a chap called Spy, as some of our shop stewards are, he said, "I remember the past. I remember when I could get the tram to the sea, to the beach, when I could stand on steel cans at the football," of course they were empty, "and I could go to a lane in St Kilda and buy a bottle of sly grog as opposed to a needle or a cap of heroin. The world," his Spy says, "are changing." Well, I think there are ways to do it, but I do think that this changing world involves the recognition of rude, unpalatable facts that change our world and change our lives. I believe if we can work around these facts, we'll prevail. And as we respond to change, I believe that we can identify consistent themes in Australian life by which Australians are organising their busy lives, which will allow us to prevail and enjoy 100 years of life to match the 100 years of life that medicine and neurological science may give us. The first of my 5 themes is that in a coming century, the age-old expectation of one job and one organisation for life will no longer be there for any of us, except perhaps Jamie Packer. What happened to ANSET and Enron and HIH and FIA and Harris Scarf, and what's happening now at Telstra, with respect to our hosts, and indeed looking internationally with the many, many young people who go to Qatar and the Emirates to work for a few years and send money back to their families in the subcontinent or the Philippines. All of these changes show how transient and fluid jobs are, and indeed what was once called adventurous, our world has become, and I think was bound to become once, of course, travel became much more cheaper and accessible. The need for particular labour skills in our world and particular expertise is always varying, much more so than in the past, especially when we look at some of the transient concerns which we get excited about, from the Y2K panic to the hyperbolic expectation, soon proved wrong, of the dot-com revolution and cold fusion and the film career of Madonna and the opera Titanic. Everything's changing. Forms of work will come and go, like the saddler, the local telephone switch girl, the cooper, the felt hatter, the rope maker, the moulder, the boy selling chocolates from a tray in a red cap and a cinema, the life insurance agent, the shorthand typist, and the word processing pool. Remember the pre-ATM bank clerk. All of these jobs will dwindle dramatically and continue to dwindle in numbers or go overnight. And retraining for new forms of work once or twice or thrice in a lifetime, or developing early multiple skills, will become the norm, the expected pattern of the future. It is, I suppose, interesting or amusing to list the jobs and job descriptions that will always be there. The cleaning lady, the taxi driver who sometimes knows where they're going, the train driver, the hotel receptionist, the live jazz band leader, not a big number, the newsreader, the journalist, good news for our hosts, the weather girl, the priest and the politician. But in the main, whatever the country, whatever the nation, Australia's no exception, whatever the ambient religion and moral tendency, the times are changing and changing rapidly. And I believe that one of the themes Australians will experience going forward, a frame, if you like, of public policy, is that we'll have to become students again, apprentices again, interns again, trainees again, job applicants again. That's our prevalent future. And we should, without acrimony, without shame or even undue vengefulness, be soon prepared to accept this. The next theme around which I think Australians are organising their future, from which public policy can learn, the next thing to realise is the need to pace ourselves, which means making sure that you don't drop dead on a Victor Harbour bowling green a year after you retire, the way shift workers classically do. Dropping dead early has no upside to it. You miss out on your grandchildren and they miss out on you. You miss out on those reflective years by the beach with those CDs you wanted to play and the great works of literature you never caught up on. The dream, as Kim Beazley once put it, of breakfast with good coffee by the beach at 9 a.m, a leisurely half-mile walk to the second-hand bookshop, and after that, pure joy. We have to make sure that our physical body is still in shape by then and not hobbled by a stroke or one of the thousands of workplace injuries that occur each year in South Australia and Victoria alone. This is a quality of life issue, and it applies equally to burnt-out white-collar workers as it does to blue-collar workers. We should be demanding that all our children have access to a school oval, a winter hall and a PE teacher. Don't smoke, walk a bit, eat your greens, live longer. Because work, as union officials will tell you, however richly paid, is not the primary thing in life. However much you make from it and spend from it, you can still only eat 3 meals a day and sleep in one bed at a time, especially if you're wise. And the precious magic years you have with your children come only once. And you'd better be there for them and not in a plane in turbulence over some part of the world reading a report. There are other surprisingly joyous things, a family reunion or a school reunion, an extended second honeymoon or the wedding of an old friend in a country town. They're probably worth postponing a meeting for. As my wife reminds me, the last telephone calls of those that died on 9/11 revealed lovers and poets and family members, not shareholders, deal makers or number crunchers. People who were calling up to say, I love you so much. Another theme, and this is as hard as it gets, I think, is you have to be prepared at least once in your life for a catastrophic, traumatising, paralysing change. It doesn't have to be a bushfire on the Eyre Peninsula or an earthquake in Newcastle or a cyclone in Innisfail or a mine collapse in Beaconsfield that brings this catastrophe on. It can be the death in the family, a divorce, a debilitating disease or sudden unemployment after the arrest for fraud of your CEO. But one thing's for sure, one of these things will happen. It could be the demented mother-in-law who comes to live with you. I meant to change that. For father-in-law. I have no role models for that. It might be a disaffected adolescent child on drugs. It could be diabetes or multiple sclerosis or osteoarthritis. It could be the soul-destroying search at the 17th job interview, or the 17th interview to find dignified aged care accommodation. It could be the death of a daughter and the need as grandparents to raise her children in the years you'd hope would be characterised by peace and quiet. These things, I fear, are our common fates as humans, and one of them will happen to you. Robert Frost, the American poet, perhaps he was right when he called them the shocks and changes that we need to keep us sane. He's writing of his own son's suicide, but perhaps he was not. The inevitability of catastrophe is a fact of life. It's written in our DNA, I suggest. Our capacity to deal with such events, or at least expect them, is a big part of the life we live, and indeed the emotional goodness of it. Like a change in the workplace, it will come, and we have to be prepared for it. My fourth hypothesis about the themes of continuity by which Australians are living longer and coping with globalisation is a cheerier one. I do believe that Australians need to prepare for the likelihood that in their life cycle, many of them will very probably become millionaires. We've now had 20 years of rising prosperity and falling unemployment rates, although not all due to the Howard government. The average Australian, I suggest to you, is wealthier now than they were a generation ago. And this isn't just a quaint way of saying that Jamie Packer is richer than before and that your wages stayed just the same. This move to wider prosperity is likely, although I have to say it's not certain nor universal for all Australians, this move to prosperity for many will continue. It's important we learn how to manage our rising wealth and provide for our later lives and insulate ourselves if we can from that catastrophe. In view of this, and it may well be, and I put this to you tentatively, there's probably no point in pushing people out into the workforce when you're 20 or 18 or 15. Perhaps it made sense in 1600 when a man's lifespan was 42, or in Russia now where it's in its late 50s. But to merely work in a dead end job from which you can be retrenched or replaced by an overseas worker, when you can be multiply training yourself for a changing world in education in a great university or travelling the world, or expanding your soul in the galleries of some other city, or the temples of the East, or learning a musical instrument, or playing serious sport. Seriously, there is no alternative to improving yourselves in these ways. If you allowed your student, be it your university or technical years, to go on till you're 25, perhaps we could begin mortgage-paying years at 30, and protracted your working years in some form or another which you're comfortable with till at least 70, and your part-time volunteer years until you're 85, and your golfing years until you're 98. Perhaps you'd be doing yourself more good, and the economy vastly more good, than you may be with your present life plan. I suppose this is one more way of saying you have to pace yourself, and you have to be doing things of interest at every age. Even as grandparents avidly involve themselves in their children's children in their 70s, there must be a place for people in their 70s and 80s as teachers, mentors, trainers of the traditional trades, swimming instructors, saxophone players, advisors in the arts of life and the scrutiny of history. There must not be a time where you become, as some of the old do now, invisible. Perhaps a system where, as national service, young people look after a single old person or an old couple for a year in return for a free university course would solve a lot of the difficulty we're in. That is, the difficulty of disproportion born of insufficient skilling or multi-training in the institutions that lie at the heart of the success or failure of a nation, a culture, an empire. That is, the teaching institutions. It's the most educated countries, Sweden, Iceland, Japan, that have the most workers in their 60s, because after all, educated people always have more to bargain for with their skills in the market of life. Another thing, and I'd put this a little less tentatively, is that it's almost with axiomatic foreboding I warn my members not to realistically expect that any large fraction of much of the current social security safety net will be there for their great-grandchildren in 2060, the way current conservative Western governments are going. We have to index our savings and do it early. I think people will find that a lot better in their first century of life than the credit card debt. The final, and perhaps most enduring hypothesis, and it's pretty obvious really, is you need to have another dimension outside of work. What Shakespeare called a world elsewhere. It could be a sporting pursuit, it could be a reading group or piano lessons, or study a foreign language, or even a press club lunch. It can be something as simple as a regular Scrabble game with constant friends. It can be working with disabled children, or taking a Labrador to visit the nursing home, or running errands for the old. And its worth is obvious, I think. If you can find someone, all of you who are researchers and studiers of history and politics, if any of you can find someone who says the following, "I shouldn't have gone to the Sydney Olympics," or "I didn't like watching our football teams play last Sunday," or "I really regret that European trip," or "I wish I'd never gone to Canberra to see that exhibition of impressionists," or "hearing Joan Sutherland sing at La Scala," or "Jimmy Barnes at the Yarram Entertainment Centre," if you hear anyone say they were the worst decisions that they ever took, or watching those 200 episodes of The Simpsons last year was a big, big mistake, then you're a far better and more diligent researcher than I am. I'm suggesting to you these parachute drops that we take into other worlds and other universes should start early. Why should we wait till you're 60 to discover the pleasure of dancing lessons? You can meet many more interesting people cheek to cheek than you might otherwise. It's been once wisely said that each of us lives in two nations, work and home. Home includes not just solace of the day, but a life of the mind. In the music you listen to, the films you rent, the board games you play, the language of jokes and the catch cries you have with your children, we have a life on earth that affirms the sacrifice and burden and tedium of the work that we do that pays for this. And this is why the education we have and the mind we form in our classrooms are far more important than anything else. It's what gets us through. It's what picks us up when you're depressed or you lose your job and you quickly need another. The way things happen now is that we seem to spend our whole lives narrowing down to specialise in a job that may be gone tomorrow when a machine roughly shoves you aside and costs the CEO less money. We can't afford to define ourselves by our work. Another man's wisely said that a map is not the territory, a CV is not the life. You have to have a vision of yourself that's prouder than your job description, or bitterness can plague the rest of your life. I find in my union middle-aged men who lose their jobs sometimes can feel it more than women. Men sometimes tend to invest much more of their identity in the paid jobs they do, whereas women are more likely to see value in the roles they play outside of the office. But a man who defines himself by what he does, and so many of my members do, can sometimes tragically topple into tragedy, and very quickly into drink or immoderate behaviour or worse, because sometimes he doesn't realise that a map isn't the territory and a CV is not the life. So you must, in these challenging times I'm suggesting, begin to future-proof your life. You must be able to look in the mirror and see the grey-haired person that will be looking back and learn to like them. You must develop an enduring sense of your own self-worth by educating yourself up to your capacities, fulfilling yourself in ways that go beyond work and invent, or invent and make money from the work that you love. And you can't do this on your own. I'm suggesting that we need government policies and corporate decisions, union activity and public debate that sees as far as individuals do. We don't need a hex, Deb, that puts your grandchildren into hock for your education. Nor should we be keeping the academically talented working class from their calling and their fulfilment in good universities. We need billions poured into country towns where catastrophic diminution is as great over time as that of New Orleans. We need acting schools, perhaps, and adjacent theatres in country towns. We need regional orchestras to help fulfil the artistic impulse in adolescents who may otherwise make disastrous decisions from sniffing glue or taking ecstasy for want of expansion of their mind. We need perhaps fairer tax rates for employers and employees, so we have a real stakeholder society and not just a cardboard replica of one. Perhaps we need a tax system that doesn't allow 260 deductions for CEOs on millions a year and none for the worker on the shop floor. Perhaps we even need community radio stations in abundance, where old people can play the music they love and do talk back at 3 a.m. with equally sleepless contemporaries. Perhaps we need a payment, not just a baby bonus, but perhaps a means-tested childcare subsidy for the genuine stories, where grandparents in whose house grandchildren spend a significant amount of time because both parents have to work 80 hours a week to keep their heads above water. I'm suggesting today at this lunch that we need corporate and public policy commitment to lifelong learning. We need more flexibility for women who shouldn't have to face the invidious choice between women and between children and jobs and income and mortgages. We need less discrimination against older people in the workplace who can't afford to retire. We actually need, I suggest, employers and industrial relations laws who understand what their employees see in their future mirror. Politics and community and unions, in conclusion, should always be about the fundamental themes of life that never change. I'm suggesting that unlike work choices, we need a centenarian sensibility. Just as Don Bradman never set out to make less than 100, if we intend to live for 100, to be 100, we should play the game for a century of life. We need a centenarian sensibility that allows in our time on earth reflective time in both youth and age. Approval in both parts of the life, of this life, for the core, the hinterland, that's you. And not just the map of you or the CV or the obituary, but allows us to spend those 100 years well and leave in good shape the country, the society, the tribe, the culture, the country town, the nation that we've helped to build. So today I'd like to wish you all long life to a centenarian strategy and invite you to judge public policy in that context. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. Certainly a thought-provoking talk. I think Rex Jury might be a few lines for you there somewhere. And Rex Jury at 100, beggars belief. I'd now like to invite some questions from the floor, from some of the journalists in the room, please.
Craig Bilstead is my name, from the Advertiser and a member of the Press Club Committee. Very thought-provoking. And as you can see, I'm looking after my body as if it were a temple. hoping that I'm going to achieve.
I don't know what your God is, but I accept it's a temple.
An issue that you didn't touch on, but I think we as South Australians are interested in, our Premier is running for National President of the ALP, and we expect to hear in the next 24, 48 hours whether or not he's been successful. From your perspective as a, I think you're still Victorian President of the Labor Party and National Secretary of the AWU, how do you see Mike Rann as National President? What skills, what special attributes do you think he can bring to that role that's going to help you? And what are the negatives for us in South Australia? What sort of a distraction is it going to be for him putting effort and concentration into that role? Did you vote for him?
So I'd welcome the questions of the day today, and I did want to use you as an opportunity to talk about life beyond the day-to-day, but I do welcome questions about these issues. I voted for Mike Rann. Do I think it'll distract him? I think he's a bloke who's capable of multitasking, and I think you've got a very good Premier. And when you look at some of your economic statistics, South Australia is doing far better, perhaps, than if it had a different set of leaders. In terms of the job you'll do as National President, one of the National Presidents if he's elected, I think that Mike Rann represents that strand of the Labor Party which is successful, state Labor. And I do think sometimes there's a challenge in Canberra, and I'm not under Kim Beazley, but perhaps previously, that there are lessons in the performance of state Labor governments for Labor federally. And if he has the opportunity to bring his success and bring his lessons to federal Labor, I think federal Labor will only be enhanced.
Rex Jury from the Advertiser. This body is not a temple, it's more like a block of flats. Two questions, one light-hearted, the other serious. The Liberal Party in South Australia looks like going into the next federal election with no female candidates, and that's a free hit for you really, but on the broader question, when are women going to take serious positions within the overall union movement, and more particularly in federal politics, and more especially at the very top of federal politics? And do we need some form of legislation to make that happen? And the more serious question, is Collingwood going to trade Chris Tarrant?
At least you didn't ask me if Eddie was going to step down as president. On your less serious question, I think women have achieved quite high office within the union movement already. Something which people mightn't be aware of is that Sharon Burrow, who's the president of the ACTU, is also the president of the International Congress of Free Trade Unions, which is, I suppose, in terms of global trade unionism, the number one job. Now, unfortunately for Sharon, or fortunately, because I'm not sure she wants to spend a lot of quality time with the PM, if she was a champion golfer or a champion netballer, I think the PM would have been there having a photo with her, but because she's just won her peer respect in industrial relations, doesn't receive the attention here. And before that, there was Jenny George. For many years, some unions have had female leadership. There's always more that can be done. In terms of the Liberal Party not picking women, I'm surprised to hear that. I didn't know that. That's outrageous. I do think there's a general issue that there is still a gap in gender pay equity, and it hasn't improved in the last 10 years. So I think there's some real challenges about the complete emancipation of women in terms of economic opportunity and power. And I do think that's a sleeper issue in politics. In terms of federally, well, Julia Gillard and Nicola Roxon are pretty senior shadow ministers, and they're both very capable women leaders in their own right. So I think that the picture's pretty good. Whether or not you need to legislate that, I'm not convinced of. I'm not a big fan of that. But what I do certainly think is that courtesy of the union movement, but also in general, the Labor Party's got some very smart women nationally. In terms of Chris Tarrant, heartbreaking. You know, like, I've been there. I'm a member of the Collingwood Football Club. I don't think we should trade him. I think we should hang on to him. But if you've got a couple of players from Adelaide you'd like to let go of, you know, we'd be appreciative too. Anyway.
Yes, another question.
Hi, Nadine Williams from the Advertiser. I wanted to ask about older workers.
Yeah.
And I loved your scenario, being of a certain age, and like the idea about living to 100. However, the figures that I look at as far as when men, and in particular when women stop work, shows that most women are out of the workforce by their virtually somewhere between 55 and 59, and men, although they're staying at work a little bit longer, are still virtually not working at the age of 65. So if we're going to live to 100, obviously the idea is to stay at work, and there's a lot of rhetoric around the place, but I'm wondering what would you suggest for actually coming in with public policy to break down ageism and also possibly to change the culture in which both men and women work at the moment, so that we work, I guess, longer and can afford a much longer, better quality life.
I should say that I saw about baby girls born today, so I can't make this a retrospective theory. So you can see me for a refund if I'm wrong. I do think in terms of that, the best thing Australia's got going for it is people. That's why I'm quite a critic of work choices. The idea of forcing wages down, making it easy to dismiss people. Look, if the only thing we've got in this country is investing in people, creating laws which make it easier not to invest in people, to me, is counterintuitive to where we've got to go. There's three challenges. We've got the highest participation rate we've ever had. The government does define not being unemployed as 1 hour of paid work a week, which is perhaps a little nebulous. But nonetheless, there's something like 1.8 million Australians in various categories who are underemployed who want to work more, be it people who've suffered disabilities or people who are part-time and can't get more work or hours, or people just in full-time work who'd like to work more. So the key challenge is participation. And there's three key drivers of participation. Because as we grow older, the participation rate comes under pressure, and simply importing more people on temporary guest labour visas, or simply just saying, as Peter Costello says, have three for the, you know, have one for the nation, that is not a strategy. The three key opportunities is one, making it easier for women to participate in the workforce. Two, make it easier for older people to participate in the workforce. Three, making sure that people get more skills and training so they can cope with the ups and downs of employment in the modern world. Some specific ways you could do that. Perhaps if the federal government stopped ripping off the states in terms of GST, and there is a massive con going on with GST has delivered quite a lot of wealth to the feds, but a lot of states are underfunded for what they contribute, the economic activity in their states. But if there was adequate compensation from the federal government, perhaps state governments could look at relieving the issue of payroll tax on people who employ people over 60. Perhaps there needs to be a debate. When you have a child, and I know from employing talented women, it's not just 12 months, the impact. Perhaps if there was greater reward and flexibility for up to 5 years of part-time employment, or making it easier so the employment... And I know companies say to us, oh, we can't, you know, we just can't keep a position open for 5 years. Well, I know the smart women who work in my union, and I employ 240 people, so I don't speak just from ignorance on this question. If you force people to make choices, there was a survey recently, one in every two women delaying having kids because of employment. So I do think we can afford to go even further in terms of flexibility about mums. A third area, and I think this is pretty fundamental, is if you look at the nations who have most people working in their 60s, I mean, I'm an AWU rep. My blokes do the cement at Adelaide Brighton, they work at Castelloy, they work up at Moomba, they work at Whyalla and the steel mills. They can't necessarily keep doing the same work they were doing at 50 and 60, at 65 and 70. Your bodies wear out. But what I do think is if we start giving people lifelong learning, make the commitment real. I mean, Australia's 21 out of 29 in the OECD in education. That is not a smart strategy to dumb our way down the charts. You know, the rest of the world, the OECD average increased by 38% expenditure in education. We've gone backwards. I mean, that is dumb. So I'd say the third sort of practical public policy suggestion, other than make it even easier for women to combine work and family, and perhaps looking at some payroll tax adequately compensated by the federal government, is you've got to educate people. You've just got to keep educating them the whole time. Look at Iceland, look at Japan, look at Norway. Now, what do these countries have in common? Now, they hunt whales, okay? And I'm not saying that hunting whales is therefore the key, although my union covers whale work, so I'm not totally... No, I won't get into that debate. We're battling with uranium as it is. But what I would say is those countries have the highest participation rate of people in their 60s, and they have the highest level of educational qualification of people in their 60s. The link is clear. Why didn't the federal government put as much effort into education, a crusade on education, that are done into work choices? You know, what a squander. Forget if you're Liberal or Labor for a moment. They had the Senate. If they had declared a crusade on education in the same way they've declared a crusade on lowering wages and tackling unions and, you know, apparently we're the menace on one hand, on the other hand we're declining in membership and therefore irrelevant, get that contradiction. Education, probably the final thing, and I don't mean to give long answers to discourage questions, along with the education, perhaps we need to make our workplaces healthier and safer. People wear out. And just as I'm not convinced that the Beaconsfield mine disaster wasn't avoidable, I'm not convinced that what happened in Port Pirie, that terrible explosion, wasn't avoidable. You know, when you have 3,000 people dying of industrial disease and traumatic injury every year, I do think safer workplaces and healthier lifestyle for people at work is an adequate public policy suggestion too.
Bill, I might just throw in a question of my own. I mean, you touched on uranium just then. What's the potential for the uranium debate to divide the Labor Party, and where do you see the debate going?
One of the very good things, it's probably not one of the very good things, one of the unusual things about the Prime Minister is he does manage to unite the Labor Party. We'll have our debate on uranium, that'll be had, and then the day after we'll focus back on the government. So I don't think it has the capacity to divide us at all in terms of the next federal election. The real issues, and Kim Beazley's focused on it, the Labor Premiers are focused on it, a lot of people are focused on it, is we're a middle-sized nation trying to cope in a globalised world. As I've said, we're living longer. The real issues are education, infrastructure, tax, health. You know, really, the idea of industrial disputation was not something which was arresting a lot of decisions. So I don't think the Labor Party will let itself... We'll have our debate on uranium, what will be, will be. Then the next day we'll get on with the business of providing a legitimate alternative to the Howard government.
What do you think could be the outcome of that debate?
It can be one of two outcomes. And they are yes or no.
What do you favour?
Oh, well, I've said that... I'm not quite sure why you have uranium, why uranium mining in Northern Territory and South Australia is good, but uranium in West Australia and Queensland is bad. I accept there's legitimate points of view on both sides. For myself, I think that the debate about no new mines policy is probably reflects carbon dates, an issue in the 1980s as opposed to now. And I'm very supportive of what Kim Beazley's had to say on it.
Another question there.
Right, Dean Dowling, Atheist Foundation. I was a member of the Labor Party for more than 30 years, but resigned from the Labor Party because of people like, or politicians like Rann and Atkinson. And my question is, in 1983, when Hawke and Keating won the election, they were conned by ex-physicist John Stone, Secretary of the Treasury, by some mathematics and so on, which I didn't understand because I hadn't done mathematics. Summarising quickly, quote, Dr. Noah Coombs wrote that financial deregulation and privatisation was a tragedy and disastrous, and the outcomes highly predictable from the time the decision was made. So when is the Labor Party going to apologise for Keating's financial deregulation and privatisation?
I hope my question can be as good as your answer. No, seriously, in terms of Keating, I think on balance, Hawke and Keating's years were a contribution to Labor. They did a whole lot of reform. I have views about deregulation in certain sectors, which I think it can go too far, for instance, occupational health and safety. In terms of the exchange rate, the introduction of foreign banking licenses, in terms of the accord, I'm in support fundamentally of those changes. So I'm not sure that if I'm going to give you a lot of satisfaction on that question.
Hi, Jessica Leo from the Advertiser. Just wanted to ask you, you mentioned that less young people are joining trade unions. I just wanted to find out what you thought the reasons for that were and what can be done to reverse that trend.
In terms of union membership, I think the federal government loves to say, well, because union membership wasn't what it was in the 1970s, therefore it becomes legitimate to attack unions and therefore you say unions have no role. So my first proposition in answer to your question about union membership numbers is I think unions are still relevant. I think the reasons contributed to are external and internal. I think it's always important to get new blood into unions. But I also think the laws have become a lot more difficult than they were in the 1960s and 1970s in terms of organising people. The idea of the right freedom of association or the right to join a union has been severely transgressed, especially since 1996. I also think in terms of unions that a lot of membership in unions, and my union's a perfect example of it, is in industries who have changed. So there's been legal changes and there's been structural economic changes, but I certainly think that unions can afford to keep bringing new idealistic people to work in unions. In terms of going forward, the Howard government inadvertently has probably given a wake-up call to unions. These changes, the case wasn't made from, and a lot of rank-and-file unionists, to finish where we started earlier today, I think a lot of people who would go to the ballot box on a Saturday on an election day and vote based on a range of issues have now discovered the Howard government's made changes which affects them at work. And so I do think there's a lot of disillusionment amongst a whole lot of people who thought they were voting for the Howard government on one set of issues and have found all of a sudden the safety net, which especially for their kids and grandkids they thought existed, hasn't. So the recovery of unions and the growth is our values are still relevant as they always were. I mean, I talk to people who are, you know, Christians and they attend the mainstream religion. I say, do you think God doesn't exist because fewer people go to church? And I have to say, I mean, the Prime Minister hasn't repudiated his love of the Queen merely because a minority of Australians want to be a monarchy. But so I think in terms of unions, our challenge is not our values. Our challenge is the way we organise them, making sure that we reach out and appeal to people. And we bring new talent in and we train our shop stewards to the best level that they can to feel empowered at work. Finally, the idea of the fair go at work. Unions turn the theoretical right of a fair go at work into a reality. That can't be legislated out of existence.
Maria Mosquerito from the Advertiser. My question extends from your answer there. We've seen Labor and the union movement seem to be banking a fair bit on dissatisfaction with work choices for the next federal election, but we've seen in previous elections that the electorate's dissatisfaction with the government on a range of issues tends to fade come election day. You know, we've seen that with, you know, massive welfare cuts in their first term and refugees and Iraq and all the rest of it. So,
could you speak a little louder?
Sorry. did you heard that? No? Nobody heard that?
Yeah, I've got most of your point, yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Okay, can you hear me now? Okay, good. Okay, starting again. Unions, Labor seem to be banking a fair bit on dissatisfaction with work choices for the next federal election. Previous elections, dissatisfaction tends to fade the closer you get to election day. What's going to be different about work choices and the next federal election, if, you know.
If your question is, can the unions and Labor maintain the momentum about dissatisfaction which exists currently right up till October or November of next year?
And how do you counter that comfort that seems to exist in the electorate? Yeah.
Well, I actually think that people are disturbed. I think the pendulum swung too far. Leave aside some of the rhetoric and the, you know, the excited language from both sides of the partisans, I think most people are a bit uncomfortable with these changes. And I think the problem for the government is this. Industrial relations wasn't an issue upon which a lot of people were voting in previous elections. And for whatever reason, the federal government's made industrial relations a hot button issue. And the electorate don't think the federal government are better on industrial relations than Labor. So I think inevitably as these changes are affected one by one, it's the trickle effect actually causes more people to get upset about these changes. Also, I think that the best time for an opposition, although the South Australian opposition didn't use it, is during an election campaign. That's when more people, that's when at last you get to be on an equal footing. Judging Labor's performance ultimately, at this point away from the election, whilst it's of interest, you know, that old truism that the only opinion poll that counts is election day is right. Very hard for oppositions to get equal billing with a government. The government has at its reach, you know, all the benefits of incumbency. So I think, one, there is momentum which continues every day because these changes are ill-conceived. And I don't think the government, by doing a few cosmetic backflips between now and the election, is going to be able to correct the wrong, because the laws are fundamentally not well thought out. And also, I think, as you get closer to an election, tends to elevate an opposition. It gives the opposition an opportunity to get the equal treatment that the government normally gets for the rest of the time in the electoral cycle when the opposition doesn't get the same attention. So I think there's a thing called, the Yanks call it the big mo, momentum. I think the federal government's looking a bit tired, like the AWB report's not going to be the government's finest moment. Mind you, none of the AWB's been the government's finest moment. I do think there is legitimate concern about interest rates. I do think that, you know, it's interesting when you talk about, the government love to talk about interest rates under Keating. There's two facts. One is when Howard was Treasurer under Fraser, they were in the 20% range. Secondly, but even more significantly, Australians are now spending 21% of their household disposable income on their home loans and repayments in a way which there was only 10% 10 years ago. Or put another way, Aussies 10 years ago were paying just over 5% of their household disposable income on interest payments on mortgages. Now they're up to 9.6%. This is big pressure. So I think the government hasn't used the commodities boom. It's spent the money, $248 billion in extra tax receipts since 2000 to now, out of $261 been spent on interest group payments, whereas we haven't reinvested or saved. So I think the economic indicators aren't as pretty for the government as they should be by virtue of the government handling, and I think there's genuine concern about industrial relations, and as the opposition gets closer, there's an opportunity to look like the government in waiting as opposed to just a carping negative opposition.
Just a couple more questions, Ralph Clark.
Ralph Clark, Buller McKenna News, subsidiary of News Limited. If I could just turn your attention to foreign affairs for a moment. Do you support the various resolutions of the United Nations that Israel withdraw to their pre-1967 borders and their occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and remove entirely their illegal... That may be a big question mark, if not for me, but for my 25-year-old daughter. And I'd like to know from you, as a rising star on the Labor Party and destined to go into Parliament, what we're going to do about the Middle East.
Yeah, I think... You're right about the challenges of foreign policy impacting upon ourselves, just as global economics has an impact. I'm not an expert in foreign affairs, I'll put that up front, and whereas Kevin Rudd's our foreign affairs spokesperson, and I'm learning as a prospective Labor candidate that you can't always comment freely on every topic because you've got shadow ministers already out there. What I do believe in, and I'm not familiar with every resolution passed by the United Nations on the Middle East, what I certainly do believe is in what they call a two-state solution. I think Israel has a right to exist, and I also think Palestine as a country has a right to exist. I'm just trying to answer your question to the extent of the knowledge I have. In terms of what Australia can do about the Middle East, I do think that the Howard government could have done a lot more to work in the forum of the United Nations in the lead up to the Iraq confrontation, the Iraq war. I do think that for Australia, one of the contributions we can make is to be strong in our local region. So, in terms of our relationship with Indonesia and our neighbours to the near north. In terms of Israel, and I suppose that's the nub of your question, I've been to Israel. I do think that there's a lot that's good in Israel. And I also happen to think that Israeli politics and Palestinian politics needs to be pretty strong and robust. And I do think that what Australia could do is help contribute to the training and quality of Palestinian and Israeli politics in terms of helping a system develop their civic institutions, which I should say includes trade unions.
Greg Kelton from the Advertiser. Yesterday the Prime Minister was here to sign the 1 millionth AWA. When he was conducting a press conference, he spoke about the skill shortage, which, as we know, is one of the biggest problems facing Australia at the moment. And he said that there'd been too much emphasis placed on universities and tertiary education as career paths, and not enough people were going to technical colleges. One, do you agree with that? And what would the Labor Party suggest in that area? And two, are you the next Labor Prime Minister of Australia?
I'm not sure. I don't believe it's an either or. I don't think the federal government spent enough on education, full stop. I do think the federal government at the last election, I think the ads which had the worst impact upon the federal government run by the Labor Party in the last election were the ads intimating the high cost of education, the $100,000 degrees. Perhaps we came out with them a bit late, but I thought they were pretty effective ads. And I know the Howard government did, because then the Howard government, as some of their fairly clever spin meisters did, came up with the $800 toolbox allowance. Everyone says, well, a toolbox is a good idea. And I think that was in direct response to a sense of vulnerability. So I do think it's not either or. I think in terms of education, as I said earlier, the proportion of public expenditure on education has fallen in the Howard years. The number of people being trained in the traditional trades has fallen. The number of Australian kids being trained at university has fallen. I think the high level of HECS is a disincentive to people. The way they're structuring the HECS is a disincentive. I don't think Labor can go wrong pushing forward on education both for universities and TAFEs. And I think the more that Labor talks about education, the more it comes up with ideas to make it accessible. And also, the more we talk about lifelong learning, the more we talk about making it easy to get adult apprenticeships. I deal with people every day who work perhaps in the automotive components industry or the steel industry, sectors which are facing tough times and redundancies. And I just wish corporate Australia would step up to the plate a bit more and accept that they should be training people in generic skills for their next job, not just their current job. This culture of saying we'll pay someone a redundancy and that's our obligation that this person finished after 20 years is an insufficient and sterile response. So I think it's not just TAFE, not just uni, not just those sort of headline issues I mentioned, but from my particular industrial perspective, perhaps unions should be starting to make claims that if someone's going to be laid off, they also pay for that person's retraining as well as just a handshake and a goodbye and see you later and thanks for the 20 years. Oh, question two, sorry. Kim Beazley can be the next Labor Prime Minister of Australia. In terms of myself, I'm not even there. So, and there's a lot of good people there. Be happy to be part of an incoming Labor government, which cannot surprise you as an answer.
Francis, we're running out of time. Just a quick one.
Very quick. No one's mentioned Medicare bill.
Oh, they should have. Okay, I'm sorry. but in terms of Medicare, the private... Doing the, I think the government, it's interesting, the Prime Minister certainly is no one's fool, and this talk about privatising further healthcare in Australia, he's dropped like a hot potato. I mean, if he really wants to guarantee he'll lose the next election, he'll continue down that path. One of the problems we have with the private healthcare rebate, and it's a challenge for policy makers, is this. The people who are most able to claim the rebate and buy private health insurance are at the higher income levels, so you almost have an inverted triangle. You know, the skinny point at the bottom and the broad point at the top. And what's happening is the people most able to claim the rebate are at the higher income levels. And we've got a lot of, we do not have a well-funded healthcare system in Australia. And simply passing on rent profits to private health insurance companies, absent any other solutions, is not a long-term viable model. And we will head the way of the United States if we're not careful, where healthcare is not well-funded. And it still becomes yet an increasing part of the expenditure of the nation. So I think Medicare is a rich area for the Labor Party to get people to focus on voting Labor at the next election.
Thank you, Bill. Bill Shorten said recently, reading one of his speeches, that winning or losing Australian elections in the 21st century is far less about being left or right, but much more about being in the right place at the right time. And you get the feeling Bill Shorten's time has arrived and that Canberra might just be the right place for him. We'll certainly wait and see. Bill Shorten, thanks very much for speaking to us today. And
thanks, Grant. Yes, geographically, we've just launched the biggest 3G network in the world. NextG is more than 100 times larger than any other 3G network in Australia. At launch today, it is also the fastest 3G network in Australia, providing data speeds 3 to 5 times faster than the current 2100 network and more than 10 times the rates of today's existing 2G digital networks, such as EVDO that you may be aware of. It's reaching more than 98% of Australians. For those of us who are often out of the office, this network will enable easy access to email, downloading large files, video conferencing, wherever there is NextG coverage. And also superior in-building coverage means that customers will maintain their video calls in areas where they may have dropped out or services were not available in the past, like, you know, often if you're in a lift and the phone drops out. So in-building coverage has improved greatly as well. So it now gives me great pleasure to draw the prize, which is actually one of the first 3G phones in Australia. So the lucky winner. Drum roll.
Drum roll. There you go.
Okay.
Oh
no.
Sure. Have you found out what to do with your phone at the moment? Come on. Come on. There you go. Come on. Come on. Pay good money. Yes. You can never find Rex after 1 o'clock now.
Not anymore. Can't hide.
Okay. So what have we got next? We've got some beer from SA Brewing. So.
I'll try and pick another one. Right down the bottom.
Ian Marshall, do you like your beer? No, you like your wine. Do you like your beer? Come on then, Ian.
So,
there you go, Ian. It's down there. Unfortunately, it's a bloody great box full of it, but can you manage that? For our first pack of CDs. Hold it?
Yeah.
One pack will do. Just three together. We have a blue D40. Chris. Okay, for some more CDs. Blue D68, Helen Lemessurier. Some CDs. And finally, a writing compendium. We have purple D74. No, D74. I think we should draw it again. Well, it's
It's got purple on here, D74. If you've got a D74, we'll take it. You got a D74? Oh, yeah.
Definitely purple.
This is a blue, and it's D6. Tyze is having a good day. Thanks again for Colette for presenting that great prize from Telstra. Before you go, a reminder about our next luncheon. It's on Thursday, October the 26th with Mick Kilty, the Federal Police Commissioner, and you can collect an invitation to that lunch as you leave today. And our joint luncheon with the National Press Club on November the 22nd with Malcolm Turnbull, on a subject vital to us all, the future of our water resources. And for those of you who are not on our emailing list or our mailing list, please leave your business cards on your way out. Thanks once again to Bill Shorten for today, and thank you all for attending.